Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are joined by Dr. Jiangwan Bourdais Park. Jiangwan is an associate professor in political science at the School of International Studies. Before joining UNNC in 2022, she held academic positions in Hong Kong and Kazakhstan, and was also an adjunct professor in Paris and a visiting professor at the University of Seoul.
Jiangwan holds a PhD in political science from the London School of Economics and completed an MPhil in environmental policy at the University of Cambridge. She also worked as a consultant, policy analyst, and senior researcher at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris, specializing in environmental and developmental assistance.
Derek, that's like really impressive, all of that.
Yeah, very impressive.
Like, we've got a lot of, you know, LSEs in there, Cambridges in there.
It's like, absolutely true. I look forward to hearing more.
I don't know. I kind of feel like I might be a bit underqualified now, you know.
You're
like,
overqualified in
really?
The field.
Oh,
I'm underqualified
you.
In absolutely everything today.
I now feel better. Thank you, Derek. Okay. In 2022, Jiangwan published the paper Statism as a Lifestyle, Deciphering Society in Films on North Korea and Evolving Communication Through Cinema in the Journal of Inter-Asian Cultural Studies. Derek, that's a really good journal as well.
You know what? You know so much more about all of this than
well,
me.
Well, do you know why I know it's a really good journal?
Have you published in it?
No, I was rejected from it. I was rejected from the Journal of Inter-Asian Cultural Studies. So obviously I have no bitterness whatsoever
because... It is their loss, Mary.
It really is, you know, and obviously my ego is not that fragile.
Oh, not
I completely accept that and it's fine. Everything goes on and life goes on.
But you do Asian cinema.
And I was rejected from the journal.
I just ignore that part for a second. Because you actually know what's going on.
What
here.
Do you mean by I do Asian cinema? I
you
think that's the wrong verb
on.
There.
Oh, well, see, this is today.
This sounds like I'm people who travel this. And say, I've done South America, I've done China. I have a big problem with that use of the verb, though.
I apologize. You focus some of your research on
that's
Asian
better.
Cinema.
I now feel better.
And you've been to North Korea as well.
I'm so glad you said that. I love telling people that. I have been to North Korea and I went in 2015 to run the Pyongyang International Marathon. So I like saying that because obviously it makes me seem really like interesting. And
I am fascinated.
Thank you. I'll tell more people this and I will continue to. I see this as like, you know, an achievement, I guess, on some level.
It's definitely
just got on
bucket
a plate,
list stuff.
But yeah, it's bucket list stuff. You're right. But I do remember, I really enjoyed my visit there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really nice country. It was very beautiful. Everyone was very nice. It was very clean, for instance. It worked very well. It was very like China in many ways, sort of culturally. And I do remember that after I went there, I did take quite an interest in North Korean culture. And as a film scholar, I was really fascinated to learn that they actually have a really robust film industry there. It's really good, Derek.
Well, based on kidnapping and...
Can we leave that bit out? Like, a lot of film industries internationally have done ethically dubious things.
You're not wrong.
There we
but
go.
You know what? I am not the expert in this.
Really?
You are almost an expert in this, but we have a real expert in this in the room with us.
Okay, maybe we should pass it over.
I suspect we should.
She's
here.
Very patiently sitting here and listening to the usual waffle. So, Jiangwan, welcome. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for your nice introduction. And also, I was very impressed by your courageous to go to North Korea.
Oh, I can't impress you. You're amazing. We just read all about you and all your incredible achievements and your paper, which was outstanding. Thank you.
Thank you for
the idea that you're impressed by me, it does a lot for my fragile
ego. It massages
that
ego. That's good to know.
It does, yeah. Please do tell us about the paper, because it was fascinating to read.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I wrote this paper like 2 years ago. Thank you for this opportunity so that I can, I could go over again what I wrote and clarify myself a little bit.
Maybe you could kind of give us an overview of the sort of topic and the main argument.
Sure, yeah. The title is Statism as a Lifestyle, Deciphering Society in Films on North Korea and Evolving Communication Through Cinema. In the title, I said deciphering because the North Korean films show strictly what the central authority would allow to show, but unconsciously, their lifestyle is naturally exposed to the outside world. And well, basically, I ask two questions. One is about how North Korean films reflect the country's collective identity called Juche ideology. The literal meaning is self-significance, self-reliance, which is deeply embedded in every aspect of the people's life there. And second question was films on North Korea. So it's more about the interactions with outside world, whether and how much this extremely isolated country has been interacting with outside world through cinema. I thought that it was very significant in terms of enhancing the communication through this cultural exchange in a way. So in the paper, I explained quite in detail about what Juche ideology means to the people and how it has been evolved historically. And then I chose two films. Well, I mentioned quite a few films, but I mainly focused on two films. One, Comrade Kim Goes Flying, released in 2012, and The Schoolgirl's Diary, released in 2007. I thought these films are really interesting as a good contrast, although there is a continuity. The Comrade Kim, released in 2012, that was under Kim Jong-un, the current leader, whereas The Schoolgirl's Diary, it was released under Kim Jong-il, his father, Kim Jong-un's father. Also, during Kim Jong-il's time, this film was made entirely within North Korea, inside North Korea, and directed by North Korea. But the other one was co-produced with UK, Belgium together. So I thought it was quite interesting. And just three countries were involved and produced it together. But it was first time that these foreign directors are filming about North Korea entirely within North Korea, the fiction films. Yeah.
I find that fascinating. I've seen Comrade Kim Goes Flying, and I really enjoyed it as a film. Yeah, you mentioned the significance of this film in the paper, and particularly the cooperation between these countries. I still don't know, and I'm sure our listeners will be intrigued by, perhaps you could tell us, how did this cooperation come about?
Right, yeah.
It's so unusual.
That's true, that's true. That's quite an interesting question. During Kim Jong-il, the father of the current leader, he had a genuine interest, personal and genuine interest in cultural products, including film. So he was crazy about filmmaking. So all the infrastructure that you saw in North Korea about filmmaking is all done under Kim Jong-il. But during Kim Jong-un's time, he is also interested in communication, but especially like technological side, how he can modernize the way they can make this communication more effective for propaganda reasons, but also aesthetic reasons. So he desperately wanted to cooperate with foreign producers. Also, at the time, politically, it was during a bit of a detente period. So many foreigners started to have interest in doing research and conducting research and working together with North Korean directors. This country started to open a little bit at the beginning of 2010. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the context how you could go to North Korea.
Sure.
For a leisure activity too, which is interesting.
Marathons are not
leisurely, but they're also serious sporting events.
Thank you very much.
But not something, you know, it wasn't tourism or that type of thing, right?
It kind of was, to be honest.
Oh, well, fair.
There were I remember there were a number of sort of packages that were offered by various companies where you could sort of go and see particular landmarks or a celebration or something. There was things like that. And one of them was the marathon, which is why this appealed to me.
But still, from North Korea's point of view, it's a big openness. It's a big change.
Sure. This doesn't still continue, does it?
It has been stopped because of the sanction, mainly because of the sanctions from Western countries. Mm-hmm. Because North Korea, that we know, is all about nuclear bombs, right? Nuclear bomb threats. So there's up and downs, and especially because of the war going on in Russia and Russian relations with North Korea. Mm-hmm. So the sanction becomes stricter.
Okay.
So the only way North Korea can communicate with outside world is with socialist countries or former Soviet countries.
Now, there's a really large tension between North and South, isn't there?
That's true.
Even still, I mean, I realize in your paper you say this, and
yeah, definitely.
I actually lived in South Korea for a while, 95, I think. So that was a period.
That's a long time ago.
Let's not talk about relative ages here, but there was perpetual events at that time. I think there was a submarine landing or something, and. So there's kind of this heightened tension and then a release, heightened tension and release. And of course, the demilitarized zone between the two countries is one of the kind of outstanding features there.
Exactly.
There is, though, in the paper, though, sort of building on that, you do actually talk about how South Korean depictions of North Korea have actually, or filmic depictions, have actually changed dramatically.
Right. That's true. Yeah. So, returning to your question, how the country, become open a little bit. So this openness is because of the overall detente between North Korea and Western countries, especially United States during that time. But also the concerns of these North Korean leaders is about the influx of the cultural products coming from South Korea, because there's a big disparity between North and South regarding political system.
Well, so, and the general luxuries and, lifestyle.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because the whole purpose of making films in North Korea is mainly because of nurturing socialist citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
So lifestyle through filmmaking is very important point for the purpose of the filmmaking. So the influx of all this lifestyle and luxurious goods like capitalist fake flavor from South Korea, they feel it as a kind of danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was quite interested in the way, because you picked two films with quite a difference in time between them. It's a good few years between those. And it felt like the depictions that you're referring to about the sort of relationship of the individual to the state in that way had changed significantly from these two. Could you describe some of those changes you note from the first film in 2008 to that in 2012?
Right. The biggest change that I focused in my article was about the loyalty. The first film, the loyalty is actually toward supreme leader, the individual idealization of this supreme leader. So totalitarianism is aligned between individual life and this leader. Whereas the second film, I guess it's influenced by, or some kind of negotiation between co-producers with other countries. The loyalty is really going to the party and also solidarity among class. So it's about society. So it's a real interpretation of socialism as something desirable. I mean, at least the socialist would think something like desirable. So equality. Mm-hmm. So it focuses very much about the equality between classes and the solidarity between the working class. so somehow beautifying the working class.
Mm-hmm.
I was fascinated by that, actually, because when you were describing, you know, this idea of the working class solidarity and bonding together to propel one of their members into the, I think you describe it as the elite artistic class. I found that quite striking because I, you know, the idea of these different classes within a socialist system seems to be antithetical to the overall ideology. And I think you say that as well, that it's not a state propelled idea of class, but rather a traditionalist one. And so maybe you can expand on that a little bit because, you know, from the outside, again, I'm no expert on North Korea by any stretch, but when you hear this kind of socialist ideology, that's almost, you wouldn't imagine it being that way.
Right, that's true, yeah. In fact, socialism as an ideology, implementation at society level, is two different things. So there's ideal socialism that, you know, maybe like Marxist and Leninist wanted to achieve that doesn't really exist in a real world, as we've seen in many other communist countries. So I found that the interesting point is the European socialists' interpretation or expectation on North Korea is some kind of socialist paradise having this complete equality. And achieved, you know, something, you know, very close to ideological side of socialism. But in fact, it didn't work in that way. So there is a classification and a stratification among classes, especially in the art side, as you mentioned, the elite artists that were nurtured by Kim Jong-il during Kim Jong-il's era. So actually, as I mentioned, as the professional ladder, the social ladder, the artists belong to state agencies. They could enjoy the highest level in society. They are very high income and well-treated and respected by many people. Yeah, so there was disparity, but at the same time, like in the movie, the one that I liked is the girl coming from very poor background, striving for success in sports. And everybody in the community, the mining community, in fact, the real image of the workers in socialist state, right? They all help and support. Yeah.
So this was also fascinating to me, actually, because, again, this idea of the dichotomy between viewing the state, the socialist state, as some sort of socialist utopia or the perfection of a socialist ideal versus the demonizing of that we so often see in the media. I have to admit, I'd never seen these depictions of that state as ideal, and maybe because I'm steeped in the wrong media. But I was curious, you just said it's socialist Europe will also sometimes depict this as an idealized state?
Some scholars, some communists or socialists in Europe, it's not an like mainstream ideas. Yeah. But I mean, there are some individuals who have socialist belief. They think North Korea would be one of those countries who can actually implement the idealistic socialism.
I actually thought when you were referring to the sort of idealistic socialism, I thought this was something that came from within North Korea in the way it tried to sort of represent itself, which was kind of why this sort of almost critique of the sort of class system between the artists and the miners in the movie seems so surprising, because it does seem like quite self-critical of society, which shouldn't really be encouraged or allowed in some way. I mean, is this idealization something that comes from within North Korea? Is it similar to the European construction, or is this something that is sort of critiqued within North Korea?
It's actually linked with the Juche ideology. Mm-hmm. It's very much the socialist ideology in North Korea is really nurtured internally. I explained quite a lot about Juche ideology, the historical evolution of Juche ideology. They adopted Marxism and Leninism, but even from 1955, they started to theorize their own kind of socialism, you know, kind of adaption to kind of like ethnocized socialism to fit better in North Korean society. So it's a mixture of socialism, but extremely totalitarian. So they made this systematic ideological system, which
you also
penetrated.
Oh, sorry to jump in there. It is fascinating to me as well, because I'm not very familiar with the Juche ideology, but the way you describe it, it's also malleable according to which leader was expressing it. So it's evolved over time.
Yeah, so at the beginning, like during Kim Il-sung, it was 1955, he started to make this socialism combining with strong nationalism, so ethnicized nationalism during Kim Jong-il, based on that ideology. It has been changing a little bit. Kim Jong-il wanted to focus more on the supreme leader. So it becomes more and more personalized, idolizing the supreme leader. So the people's submission is not toward the communism or the party itself, but it's more about to the leaders. So obviously, when these leaders change, the loyalty from the ordinary people also, you know, fade a little bit. So that's why the leaders have to make more effort theorizing.
That makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It wouldn't automatically go from one person to the next.
No. So they have to, because, you know, when you personalize this ideology to fit different person, you have to make the story and, you know, persuade the whole people. So otherwise the stability of this regime is very fragile. So ideology is very important. So Juche ideology, the form is there, but the contents changes.
I was also interested that, and I was pleased to see you brought in the sister of Kim Jong-un as well, who I find to be a really fascinating figure in the way that she's often portrayed in the media. She sort of seems to be this stereotypical Lady Macbeth type figure, you know, this kind of ice queen that's pulling the strings. I love this. How do you say? I somewhat enjoy this sort of dark depiction they have of her, which is so cartoonish in many ways. So I was pleased to see that you mentioned her as well. I also wanted to ask, as I sort of said at the beginning, you have a lot of movies coming out of North Korea. It has a very robust film industry. And actually on YouTube and on media sites online, these are all available to freely watch. It's very sort of impressive in that way that you don't actually realize that this treasure trove of these old socialist movies are available to watch and also more recent ones. So I'm interested in why you chose these two specific films through which to understand the industry. It seemed to have something to do with the depiction of domestic life in them.
Yeah, I wanted to see the alignment between statism and the everyday life of the people. And I found that I explained about the framework that is given from authority to the filmmakers. They have to follow some kind of format. It's called, well, seed, but in Korean, it's called 종자, what literally it means seed. So there is kind of framework. And within that framework, the contents could be chosen by the producers. And I found that these two are very similar in that way, following that format, the typical format, but contents are different. So I think it is comparable and interesting. And as I said, one is under Kim Jong-un era, the other is under Kim Jong-il era, and one is produced completely within North Korea, the other is co-produced with European producers. So I thought that, you know, they show very clearly about what I wanted to show.
One of the statements made in your article that I found really interesting was that films represent not only what the society is, but also what the society aspires to become. And I was very intrigued by that because I'm trying to contextualize that in a way that I'm not sure what society means in this context. Is this all films, or is it these particular films, or is it, you know, North Korea using propaganda in their films? Or I was just trying to understand the role of films as aspirational for society.
Well, I guess mostly was within this North Korean context. So obviously it is led by something. So we can see what society is. We can read how films represent the society, but also it's linked with the framework which is given by the state authority. This is something, when those films were made, the message from the authority is like people have to encourage it to behave like what these heroes and heroines do in the film. So depicting as a desirable socialist human beings.
It's interesting because like a statement like that, I find pretty sort of generic, in that I would see all films made everywhere as kind of some form of reflection / propaganda about society in some way, maybe, or aspirational in some way. But we notice it so much more when it's a system that we're not in, when it's North Korea in that way. Everything that we see coming out of North Korea, we interpret politically. Would that be the case? Do you think that's the case?
That's true. That's the case. But maybe my point was also, my underlying assumption was that not only socialist countries, but filmmaking has certain constraints in everywhere, especially the fiction films. There's a market. We have to please market at some point. And so there, the constraints, I mean, the nature of constraints are different, not exactly free entirely.
Sure.
Just a quick kind of practical question. Within North Korea, how are these films distributed and viewed?
Oh, yeah.
So is there a system of payment to go see these films, or are they given via state TV? I have no idea. I'm just wondering what.
I remember that cinemas are very popular. Any form of sort of collective behavior, you know, like sports.
Yeah, it's something to do with the development of capitalism today. It looks like socialist country, but there's a lot of penetration of capitalism inside. So I mentioned about marketization. So today, under Kim Jong-un era, everything you do, you have to pay. But during Kim Jong-il era, so until Kim Jong-il era, the socialist system functions better. Well, I wouldn't say better, but differently, more strictly, like state given. Mm-hmm. So the films were all free. It could be shown, any like public places. So theaters were there, but people can go there without paying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there any other means of distribution within the country other than cinemas?
Like schools and any public occasions. You know, some of the films are mandatory to see.
It was interesting thinking about these two films and the depiction of domestic life, in that we're sort of analyzing them through a very political lens, but they're very apolitical in many ways. You know, they tell very sort of standard narratives of people following their dreams, for instance. They don't actually, if you take a step back, seem to have extremely overt political ideology running through them in this way.
Yeah. That was the whole point, the important point that I wanted to show, because our understanding, our image about North Korea is pretty much built by international media, mostly political issues, nuclear bombs and these fanatic leaders and all these kind of things. So I wanted to focus on the other side of the society, because there are people, ordinary citizens, live there. It was quite interesting. Although they have to follow the collective identity, collective ideology, but they live their ordinary life. Mm. And they have, as you said, they have dreams, and also there is, I thought that, the family tensions are conflicting between generations. Also, they talk about their choice of profession, marriage, and all these kind of things. So I felt that it was an important aspect.
Did you feel, because I sort of agree with you, I think that's really important. Did you feel any pushback from the wider academic community in writing this article in that way? Because I certainly felt that there were people that were very unhappy when I said that I'd been to North Korea. Did you find that there was critique of your sort of attempt to engage with this society academically in this way, in a very kind of non-critical and objective sort of academic manner that you do very well? Did you find any critique?
Not yet.
It sounds like you're expecting it.
Yeah, but I guess I was rather neutral. I didn't have any my own interpretations about like political ideology or whatever, but I just explained in detail about the historical evolution and film itself. Well, obviously the interpretation on those films would differ depending on the scholars. But I tried to be a little bit away from political interpretation. I wanted to look at more about the lifestyle and film itself. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's interesting to me is that you've picked up on this idea of places in these films where they actually, in some ways, go against the overt ideology. So I think in particular, you mentioned at one point the idea of gender roles, that because these films focus on female protagonists, you can see a lot of the highly gendered expectations of these women, girls, and that seems to be against the overarching ideology of the state of gender equality.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, again, disparity between this ideal as socialism and implementation. So usually if we follow the ideology itself, then obviously there should be equality and there should not be a gender inequality should not be the issue. But North Korean society is part of Asia. And interestingly, they still have these traditions. So sometimes the gender role, I mean, the women in Asian communist countries, they suffer maybe both, you know, following the socialist way of living, so mm-hmm. equality in workplace. But when they come back to their family, then there's a traditional role. Yeah, so I thought it was quite interesting to pick up the girls as the main character, which really shows that what socialism should be. Although in reality, their goals, you know, their roles, their expectations on the gender role is still quite traditional in some cases. Yeah.
And it's particularly fascinating that film allows these observations to be made, whereas, you know, the media construction in things like media reports, as you mentioned, there may not be any of this background social milieu, right? So you have overt statements or events and reporting on it. And obviously there's ideology put into various forms of factual media. But because these are fictional depictions, but fictionalized, but they're meant to be within the milieu, they're actually showing, in some ways, I guess, a more rounded version of the society under question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, that was me pontificating. You're welcome.
There was a lot of pontificating. I was waiting for the question at the end there.
I'm not doing a very good job of it.
This is Mr. Waffle over here in the corner, okay?
Would you like that in a form of a question? So my question then out of this. So in the article, you talk about film as an effective medium to kind of mitigate social pressures from the regimes. This, I guess, as the kind of carnival aspect to it, mm-hmm. that the films operate. And the way you're talking about this here is that in some ways, the underlying depiction then helps people to become, you say, silently devoted to their country, even under adverse conditions. So even though there might be gender disparity, they're still going to continue. Mm. Do you think that's true, or is it the aspiration?
That's an impossible question to ask.
I'm asking her opinion.
I feel like there's so much more data, though, you'd need for that. But I am actually really interested in your opinion.
Yeah, but I think it's both. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously what we see in the film is, what the society and the central authority think desirable for the society and all people have to follow, kind of. But, I mean, in any films, there are some, fantasy as well. So it's something maybe the reality doesn't really follow that ideal. But again, if there's too big gap, then it's too unrealistic. Mm-hmm. So these films are supposed to be realistic. Kim Jong-il especially says he wants to, through filmmaking, implement social realism, a socialist realism, realistic socialism.
I think it's also worth putting that within the context of the industry as a whole, that these are domestic films. So they're depicting sort of everyday domestic life. And there are plenty of things like monster movies in North Korean mm-hmm. cinema as well. And there are plenty of sort of military movies, and there are all of these other ones as well. So these are probably the ones that, similar to us when we watch kind of rom-coms and all the rest, are sort of nearer to the end of depicting everyday life than the other kind of outlandish fantasy monster movies at the other end, I would say. There was one section that I really wanted to ask you about as a film scholar, which is when you start referring to third cinema. Mm-hmm. Okay, you start talking a little bit about third cinema, which is a phrase I haven't heard for a while. People don't tend to use it anymore. You know, it's sort of, it was very popular in the kind of early 2000s when all the books were produced about third cinema. And it's kind of become a little bit sort of out of fashion. So I was really happy to see it back and relevant in your paper here. You talk about the movie, Comrade Kim in particular, as a dialectic between first, second, and third cinema, which I found fascinating. And it also kind of, I remember a quote that I read about it from a sort of review of a newspaper, I think, reviewing it, where they said it was kind of a postmodernist film in a place where you'd never had modernism, in essence. Could you talk a little bit more about this idea of the film Comrade Kim Goes Flying in particular, and sort of North Korean cinema as becoming this dialectic between first, second, and third cinema? Maybe you have to actually explain what those are for us.
That would help me.
For Derek. Yeah, it's definitely outdated. It's also not only the area of film studies, but international relations and political science, which is my major. My major is not really a film studies, you know much better. But in my field, you know, third world, this thirdness is kind of outdated. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's very clear. It's still useful. I don't use it as a some kind of like pejorative sense of conceptualizing these countries, but there are definitely some distinctiveness.
Sure, sure.
And also, it was because I was trying to find out some theoretical background to explain these isolated countries, the filmmaking in these you know, completely isolated country, and the only the concept that I can use theoretically was this, you know, third cinema.
That's amazing, this idea that these isolated nations have been sort of preserved in this way, or their film industries have been preserved in this way. To inform Dr. Irwin here, first cinema is a sort of dominant mainstream Hollywood type movie. Second cinema is sort of seen as kind of art cinema, in essence, sort of European, maybe often associated with sort of art cinema. And third cinema is kind of post-colonial cinema, basically, isn't right. it? Kind of, in inverted commas, third world type cinema. And so these were categories of analysis that were quite popular in the early 2000s, as I said, when everyone was sort of discovering kind of non-American and non-European cinema. As we were just saying, this is not a term that's often used anymore. And fascinatingly, Jeong-won actually says this is still relevant for this kind of one interesting isolated case, which I really love.
And still, it doesn't really exactly fit what third cinema means, but that's the only way. If I wanted to theorize a little bit so that I can communicate with the scholars who are studying films, and so that they can compare different films in different places. It was not the best framework, but I thought that it was still relevant.
I really like that dialectical framework you came up with. And I was very pleased to see it used again, because it kind of took me back to my sort of film studies class.
So kind of jumping to the side of this a little bit, because I was quite interested, although it's also bringing in other forms of scholarship. You had said at one point here that the task of totalitarian government
isn't just mobilizing loyalty, but this self-motivated loyalty, which I found quite fascinating because I recall back in my early cultural studies days, the Chomsky and Herman's book, Manufacturing Consent, which actually said the opposite, that it was the job of capitalist media, which is to mobilize this kind of self-motivated loyalty, so get everyone in line, whereas totalitarian governments have guns at their disposal that they can control their citizenships with. So I'm curious, because this seems to be different, and I don't know North Korea very well. How does that fit in this context?
I think threats or fears, these are not the only tools that totalitarian governments can use for taming their citizens. They can do it for a certain time of period, but when it is bound to like several generations, like in North Korea, I think the conventional tools of totalitarian government, only like threatening, like force kind of tools, but not, they are not working. So that's why I wonder it, how all these people, are they really, well, to be honest, I don't really know. We cannot scientifically test, because you cannot really contact these people and ask whether your obedience, your submission to your loyalty is really coming from like deep inside, or it's just for to avoid any troubles. It's hard to say, but my interpretation about this country, my observation about this country is reciprocal. Not all groups of people, but there are some groups, like core, like majority of the ordinary citizens who sustain this society. They actually support the what central government does. It's a reciprocal. So to those kind of citizens, the central government is not really like forcing something. They do not threaten you know, this society. So there are some interactive functionality within North Korea. These North Korean films show that kind of voluntary submission to their loyalty. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the film in North Korea has that particular role. Mm-hmm. To impose, reinforce the ideal citizenship. So this is the way that North Korea to nurture the desirable socialist citizenship.
I think it is also worth noting that quite a lot of sort of extreme regimes or regimes that have a sort of clear ideology in this way have very robust film industries and actually put a lot of effort into filmmaking. And throughout history, we have quite a lot of examples of those, you know, kind of after the Russian Revolution or Nazi Germany as well. And a lot of these were very keen on movies. And of course, America as well, as kind of the ultimate sort of capitalist ideology of the capitalist dream in that way. So entertainment and the message through entertainment was never dismissed and was seen as a priority for a lot of these leaders and these authorities.
Yeah, and one bit of, I guess, support for that is when you're discussing the process of people who leave North Korea becoming increasingly, I guess, disillusioned with their previous existence or reacting against that, certainly does show that there's a cognitive dissonance between how their lives operate within and then without.
Yeah, that's the reason I wanted to emphasize the communication with outside world. At the moment, perhaps they do not really have this choice, but the people who could travel outside, I mean, North Korean people who could travel outside, like diplomats or expats, and the defectors, they see outside world and then they can return to North Korea. So it's their choice. Right? So they can see some options. But obviously the people inside North Korea have very limited exposure to outside world.
Is there a lot of academic study of defectors from North Korea, of people who leave the country?
Yeah. Mostly South Korean scholars.
Okay.
And yeah, there are a lot of studies, but outside South Korea, the scholarship on North Korea is mainly focused on political issues and the foreign policies of the United States and the relations between North and South Korea and U.S. and Western countries' involvement in security issues. And that was one of those reasons that I wanted to, as a political scientist, because it's very hard to collect primary sources about society in general, what is really going on in North Korea. So one example is like famous Japanese scholar on North Korea, where for decades, he has collected waste, refuse coming from North Korea. I mean, that really shows that, you know, how difficult it is to gather information about society. So I wanted to contribute a little bit of methodologically, like expanding a little bit more like interdisciplinary methodology.
That was one of my sort of the most interesting bits in the paper was that different image that these different parts of the world have of North Korea. So you talk about Europe, you talk about the US, and you talk about South Korea, and these are all countries that are ideologically quite similar, part of the same economic system and tradition, but they have quite different constructions of North Korea. And you talked about some of the US representations. And one of my favorite parts of the entire paper is when you say that Team America World Police is more researched and detailed and far more realistically depicted than most of the other representations of North Korea, which I'm sure is absolutely correct. Because of its sort of self-deprecation and self-referential sort of element there.
And of course, the interview is not. Well, one thing I guess is interesting here, there's quite literally from South Korea, familial bond. One of the big concerns was when the country split, that there were families that were split between them, right?
That has been a really like humanitarian issue. But as I said, you know, all these important social and individual issues are not highlighted much. And because security issue is very important, it dominates all the international media, especially in my field. Of course, there are scholars who, within South Korea, there are scholars who study this, you know, human rights or individual life and society. But outside South Korea, it's very rare. Yeah. And the split of family, it's also the part of that social and individual issues between these two countries. And because the split between the division of nation has a long history now, there are new division, new split between family because these defectors, they have to leave their family in North Korea and they left North Korea alone or part of their family members. So there's a new split, not just because of the Korean War in 1950s. There's a new generation, a new kind of like renewed family split.
You mentioned previously about sort of the reception of the paper, and you said that there hasn't been any criticism yet. Has there been any conversation started, do you think, by this paper that you would like to continue by the scholar, like to be continued by the scholarly field?
Apart from you two, the people who were interested in my paper were the reviewers. And the review, well, I had to revise several times. The anonymous reviewers, their comments were very helpful. And I remember one of those was about historical evolution and the entire picture of the development of film industry in North Korea. So I submitted very long report, review report, and I put detailed and these institutional changes and institutional development depending on the different period and leaders and depending on their ideology, what they want to communicate with the society. So I put all the details in the report, but I could not really include everything in the article. So I had a good discussions. Well, you know, without seeing them, I could have a good discussion about this and also about I remember there was a question about modernity, in what way I can call these two films as modern films. I wrote quite a long answer about
this. Sounds like a process that will be very familiar all the scholars listening here. It's that reviewer, isn't it, that you have to end up writing a novel for about the background.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just so this one sentence makes sense. So the big question for me is what next? How is this particular scholarship that we've been discussing today, how does it go forward? What would you be interested in doing in the future?
My primary goal of writing this article was not just about the case itself. I was more interested in how I can systematically develop methodology for interdisciplinary approach between political science and IR and cultural studies and film studies in particular. Because within IR, we talk a lot about critical theory, which stresses a lot about personal identity and social identity and cultural interactions, communication. But actually, if we do it empirically, then it became a non-political paper. So I wanted to establish more systematically for this interdisciplinary approach. So I'm writing, I'm writing a few papers at the same time, but what is relevant to this approach is I'm writing about environmental politics in ocean films.
Ocean films? So films about the ocean?
Yeah.
In terms of that,
linking with the evolution of environmentalism from political scientist viewpoint, so environmentalism as an ideology.
I'm trying to think of some movies. I mean, are we talking
Waterworld,
Titanic? They're both awful movies.
I'm not. Please tell us.
I choose only good ones.
Oh, really?
Well, I definitely look forward to that, because that theme of environmentalism is fascinating. Doesn't show up in this particular paper, but I think it's a really good one to pursue.
I'd really like to see what you do with that. So please do come back and talk to us again.
Thank you.
How about your next research project? I think both of us would like to say thank you so much for coming here today and for introducing to us and our listeners such an absolutely fantastic topic. So everybody's now going to go out and start watching North Korean movies. I think you started something.
감사합니다.
감사합니다. Thank you so much.
안녕하세요.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge, and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.